Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing?
Buckle up, you got a banger coming, folks.
Okay. An abbreviated and different intro, which must mean we have a guest, and we do. Joining us again on The Dunker Spot, the always great Caitlin Cooper of Basketball She Wrote. Caitlin, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy to be back and happy to be talking about a very different version of the Pacers than last year. I mean, we were talking about them on the upswing both times, but last year was about historic offense. This year, I think we might be talking about the other end of the floor a little bit more.
Yeah, the defense has certainly perked up. We're going to dig into it. Before we get into the Pacers dive, as they are certainly on the rise, particularly in the calendar year of 2025, I wanted to ask you a league-wide question. As you know, you do tremendous work with the Pacers, but you watch a bunch of basketball, and obviously you know a bunch of basketball. Has there been any trend or play thing or anything that's kind of caught your eye league-wide this year compared to last?
I think that we go with a, you know, pun intended, an icebreaker here. And I will say that I poke around on the numbers a lot, and this isn't going to be updated within this week, but within like the last month I was looking, and the NBA as a whole is icing fewer ball screens per 100 possessions at any point in the tracking era. This continues to trend downward. And some of that might be related to the fact that the league as a whole is running less pick and roll. But the fact that teams are pushing the action to the sidelines less than before, I think, is an interesting trend to talk about. And I think it might in part be correlated by the rise of five-out offense, the rise of bigs popping and shooting at the top of the key as a very common counter to that. But I'm curious to get the thoughts of you two on why you think that might have dipped.
Well, I'll go first, Nikias. Ice always feels like the security blanket coverage that seems like a great idea until the other team figures it out. Because this feels like the fourth time that teams have gone away from ice. Like, I remember Ryan Anderson just put a permanent end to it for at least a good 6 months. And now we're kind of back in the same circle. I think for me, it's so much of like the cutting, the spacing, the work that you can do around it. I think there's too many counters. And I just don't think that teams are good enough base-wise for those guards to get into that position to, okay, we're going to send this down. Okay, pocket pass, now what? We have an automatic advantage and we're just cooking you from now on. So that's kind of where my mind goes. I think teams are just kind of like, well, we'll just live with this. If it's empty side, we'll just live with our strong side. We'll live with the help being from here, et cetera, et cetera. That's my early beat on it.
I feel like we're on similar pages. Like, I think as both of you have mentioned, like, the spacing makes it tough as more players can shoot above the break, more bigs can pop. And even related to that, more bigs are comfortable handling the ball. So like if you do get to them on the pop, they can just flow into a handoff on the other side. And if you're trying to scramble from there and set up your defense again, it's another way for them to generate advantages. And beyond that, you already mentioned the cutting, so I won't hang here too long, but teams are just much more diligent about that. If they feel like you are a team that wants to pre-rotate to that popping big and try to force things down, they cut and get those guys out of there. And I think something that we've talked about a lot, Steve, is just in general, offenses league-wide do such a better job of getting defenses in rotation and keeping them there. And defenses obviously are working to stay out of rotation as much as they can. Ice just kind of gives you a built-in, we poke at this, you have to do something. And so I think that's a combination of those things probably why I think the ice rates are dropping.
One thing that I think that's interesting that Orlando does that I noticed, and not to already take it back to the Pacers, but I noticed in a game against the Pacers, and I've seen him do it in other games, is a lot of teams want to weak Tyrese to the left, which is going to lead to ice coverage on the left side of the floor. Orlando wanted to do that, but as soon as the Pacers would counter with a screen adjustment, they automatically blitz it, which I know is something that Steve Clifford would do with teams too, but like anytime there's a screen adjustment in Orlando, a lot of times you'll see them automatically blitz it because there's less space on the floor to be able to, you know, move the ball there. So just an interesting thing. Like they're still a team that does some ice coverage, but they have a counter to the counter.
And jumping you with that amount of length does not seem like a good time for opposing offenses if you aren't prepared for it. So I like the shout there. Steve, do you have anything on the Orlando portion or anything else you want to add to the ice conversation before we move?
No.
Okay. Well, then on that note, let's jump into the Indiana Pacers. As of recording, 23-19, sixth in the East, but a virtual tie for fifth. They are 11-7 at home, 12-12 on the road, 11th in offense, 18th in defense, 14th in net rating per clean the glass. But in the calendar year of 2025, they are 7-1, including a streak-ending win against the Cleveland Cavaliers. a 121.2 offensive rating, which ranks third in that span, a 107.7 defensive rating, which ranks third in that span, and the second best net rating in the league. So before getting into this specific stretch, just broadly, Caitlin, coming off of a deep playoff run, what were your expectations for the Indiana Pacers heading into the year?
Yeah, you were kind enough to join me when I asked a bunch of panelists for my Patreon, you know, how good are the Pacers? And I got asked that question a lot in my mailbag over the summer, too. And I think that most of us thought, like, certainly they were very opportunistic in the playoffs based on what teams were ahead of them. But also, I felt strong enough in their offense and the way that that held up against exaggerated coverages that I was expecting the offense to keep rolling to an extent when the season started. Obviously, that didn't exactly play out in the early first few weeks of the year, and we can get into some of the reasons for why that was. But I thought that they could be competitive and compete for home court advantage. What they would end up doing in the playoffs would remain to be seen, and I felt dependent on how much growth you could see defensively. But I felt like the floor of their offense was strong enough that they could be very competitive in the Eastern Conference. Now, they ended up hitting a lot more bumps in the road. For a team that had as much continuity as they didn't look like themselves to start the season. And since they had that 4-day break in the in-season tournament, that's when you could really start seeing the turnaround. Along with Tyrese, just getting back to being Tyrese was really kind of the most critical aspect here.
I know we're going to touch on Tyrese in a little bit, but I guess I would ask, because I personally had the offense baked in for Indiana to a degree. Maybe not to a historic expectation, but this is what they do. Defense will be solid. They'll move from there. What kind of took you the most by surprise early on where it's like, didn't see this part hurting them offensively?
The loss of the transition frequency, for sure. Even in the early parts when the offensive rating had dipped, their half-court offense was still holding up. It was that they had lost, you know, early offense is better offense for the league as a whole, but definitely for the Indiana Pacers. And they just weren't getting out in transition as much, and as much as you don't want to connect all that to Tyrese, it was very evident early in the year that things that you're used to seeing from him, you know, jumping up and down, peeking over his shoulder because he's already looking down the floor to see where hit-ahead passes are, that wasn't happening. And some of that's because he was being picked up and face-guarded full court. The league got a lot more physical with him. There was more exaggerated coverages, but you were also seeing him like point, like even in games when Andrew Nembhard wasn't available, they're up in Toronto and he's pointing for Benedict Mathurin to bring the ball up the floor. That for me was a very early sign that, you know, he's limited by something here. I don't entirely know what it is, but this is abnormal. This isn't usual. So their average time to get across half court in the first, you know, week or so of the season was much lower, even when Tyrese was out there, which wasn't common. And then it wasn't all just that. I would point to their spacing template. They're a team that really likes the two-side fast break. There were times where, you know, the trail man was running in front of the ball handler and cutting off the ability to penetrate. There was times where there'd be three players on one side of the floor and nobody would cut to reconcile it. And like, as much as I just said, they had a lot of continuity. This is the same roster, but different guys were playing. Like, they had to reincorporate Benedict Mathurin into what they were doing. Jairus Walker is now a rotation player. Some of the players on the team have kind of one style of play. Some of the players on the team have a kind of another style of play, and they've had to reconcile that. Some guys have improved as the season has gone on. But, I mean, I thought that was the most dramatic aspect, was in addition to some of the struggles that Tyrese was having and them having to adapt to the way that the league had found ways to slow them down, was also that, you know, it wasn't exactly the same team that they were running in the Eastern Conference Finals.
I think the Tyrese thing was something that I talked a little bit about earlier in the year that was more interesting to me than concerning. It ended up being an extended stretch of, we'll call it weirdness for the Indiana Pacers to start the year. But I was like, I wonder what the balance for Tyrese is going to be in that aspect. Because I think part of the beauty of him as a player is he is unselfish. Like, he is obviously someone that can jump, start a break, and in general can just lead high-level offense. But he's willing to hit ahead to Andrew Nembhard, hit ahead to Pascal Siakam. Y'all go, and I can still find my pockets later. He's very willing to do that. And striking the balance between being willing to do that and being kind of taken out sometimes for stretches of time was an interesting balance that I thought he was trying to strike there. And so it's kind of interesting to hear your take on what that looked like and kind of your surprise by it.
Yeah, because, I mean, Nembhard's been definitely a key, not only defensively, but offensively. I mean, I had written an article about how do you dial back some of this pressure against Tyrese. You know, if you're in Milwaukee and Andre Jackson's face guarding him, if you're in Memphis and he's seeing that to an extent where I literally have a possession on Twitter where in the half court, Tyrese isn't even in frame because he's being face guarded to such an extent, despite what his struggles were. The league was still treating him like a top option that they were having to adjust to a point where, you know, pretty soon Miles Turner tries to go spring him, and then neither Tyrese or Miles are even in frame. and you're playing, you know, 3-on-2 with Siakam getting doubled. And there are times where the Pacers really like that. They like to play 4-on-4, especially if you can have Siakam draw a second defender. You're getting an advantage there. But it is true. It is the balance. And, you know, times with, you know, teams weakening him as much as they did, Tyrese had to kind of learn how to free himself up as a shooting guard, how to be, you know, and he's talked about this, learning from Buddy Hield. What did Buddy Hield do as a screener to get himself open? What the points per chance have been that's risen for Tyrese as a screener throughout this year at various points. It is a balance, but I think with Tyrese not being as limited as he was, that they've actually kind of benefited from some of that period because they can be more flexible now with who is the ball handler. Like, you'll see that a lot of times in late game situations. They love running 3-man wedge roll actions between Tyrese, Nembhard, and Siakam. And they'll flip flop, you know, who's the ball handler in that situation? Who's the wedge screener in that situation? So that was definitely a big storyline throughout the early portion of the year.
I think related to the offense, we're definitely going to dig into the defense in a little bit. But with the offense with Tyrese and Pascal in particular, we now have a larger sample of those two guys together. These are two all-star caliber at minimum talents, obviously. How have you kind of seen their chemistry grow? And I guess team-wide zooming out, how have you seen Rick Carlisle kind of balance the more up-tempo, free-flowing style of Tyrese with the more methodical, let me get in the mid-post and bully you style of Pascal?
I think that's the beauty of it right there, right? Because I had some questions. I mean, we all know what Rick Carlisle's quote was when he was coaching in Dallas with Kristaps Porzingis and what he felt the future of the post-up play was. We also know what Domantas Sabonis's role ended up looking like before he got traded for a time where you could tell there was some pushback between the two of them. Sabonis wanted to play in triangle concepts. Rick Carlisle doesn't really like to play triangle concepts. So I kind of wondered, you know, what will this look like? But it's been pretty organic, especially this year now that Pascal's had a full training camp. You know, for Pascal, he has such a knack for creating angles. He has those long strides. He can finish with either hand. But it's about, for them, they still find a lot of quick hitters. It's about getting early seals for Pascal, early work. They'll have a few sets that they run for him to get post-ups, but the post-up is never the only end game of that set. So it's like, you know, you might have Pascal come up from the corner and screen for Tyrese and get that mismatch. But if the mismatch isn't there, they keep playing and they'll get to the next thing. They'll go set a stagger. Somebody will cut to the opposite wing. That'll become a go screen. It's always connected to something else. So some of the, you know, the qualms that Rick Carlisle had many years ago where, you know, this isn't a good play for our league. It takes too long. Like, it saps clock. You know, you guys draped all over you. You can't enter the ball in. They found unique ways to adapt and do both of those things. And as far as it is stylistically, you're right. Like, Tyrese and Pascal can be very different. I felt like last year they needed that knuckleball, and I still think that. But they've also found lineups that I think, like, when you look at the way they orient who's playing with who, like, a lot of times at the end of the quarter, it'll be Tyrese, TJ McConnell, Ben Shepherd, Obi Toppin, Miles Turner. And then when it's the Pascal bench lineup, a lot of times it'll be more Pascal, Jarris, Benedict Mathurin. So there's, you know, the fast up-tempo, free-flowing style unit, and then there is also a more deliberate style unit that suits both of them.
I was going to say, one of my favorite things about watching Pascal this year has been when they get a stop and you clearly see him take 1, 2, 3 quick steps. It's like, where is he going? Oh, he's going to the block. Well, whoever's down there has now do a Pascal Siakam early in the clock. Do you like him kind of getting those post-ups that way? Do you like kind of him being involved in some of the movement to get off the catch sometimes? Maybe it's a stagger, maybe it's a curl. Feels like there's a little bit more intention to get him on the move at times more this year.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because they didn't have like a lot of sets where it was like, let's run something specifically to get him a touch after he came over last year. And that's sometimes like, you know, they could be playing the Cleveland Cavaliers and he might be guarded by George Niang for 5 minutes and he didn't even get a shot. Like, those were legitimate things that happened. And now, like I said, sometimes you might see like what you just mentioned, like a little twirl action out of floppy with between Tyrese and Siakam to get him moving to the opposite side and get him a clean catch in the post, those types of things. But yeah, I really like the early hit ahead work that they do, especially with their momentum in transition, because if the other team isn't getting back, and even before the corner's filled, it's creating such a big catch area for Pascal when that backside defender isn't there yet. They really like those high seals for him to get under the underside. And because they have multiple point guards in Tyrese and Andrew Nembhard and TJ who aren't afraid to throw those passes, it becomes a lot more workable for them than what it might be on another roster.
And just quickly to the Pascal post up front, nearly 1.2 points per possession on any trip featuring a Pascal Siakam post up, which is fair to say one of the best marks in the league. And then just quickly pulling this up on Second Spectrum. Just talking about some of the action before Pascal gets some of those post touches in the half court. Last year, this includes the Toronto stint, 37 post ups with an off-ball screen coming before it for Pascal. He's already at 37 this year with the Pacers, just to kind of signify they are doing a little bit more to loosen up defenses before Pascal gets those touches. And again, he is just bullying folks once he gets those mismatches down there. And then related to Tyrese and Pascal together, a plus 5.3 net rating with them on the floor this year. When they're in the pick and roll together, 1.17 points per possession, which is the second best duo in the NBA among duos that have logged at least 200 reps. The Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic pairing number one right now. So they are absolutely finding some stuff. I think because you mentioned the lineup point, I think is interesting. How have you felt about the Pascal on Tyrese off lineup so far this year?
Pascal's propped up. I mean, that's probably a harsh word because their bench lineups have been good for a while, but the units with Pascal out there have usually been quite good for them. I will say that there are some moments, there are some rough spots there where they're playing TJ with four fours at one time where, you know, it's Pascal, Jarris, Johnny Furphy, and Obi Toppin all at the same time where, you know, they were trying to put as much length as they possibly could around Obi Toppin at the five because they didn't really have a backup center. And then it was like, you know, TJ's usage rate's getting up over 30%. It's just like TJ trying to make sense of a really strange grouping. But I think that there's times where they could probably, you know, this is going to sound kind of counterintuitive to what I just said before, but where they could play through Pascal a little bit more even with some of those bench units. And right now TJ's kind of been going through, like, he looks like he's hitting a little bit of a wall in a few of these games where he's still getting into the paint, but he's not maybe doing it with quite as much burst as what you would have been seeing earlier in the year. That's why they kind of have to be careful with how much they expand his minutes at times. But those groupings have been, I think by the numbers, if I'm looking at what you have right here, I think by the numbers, the units with Pascal have actually been a little bit better than the units with Tyrese, although I'm sure probably some of that's being weighted down by just what Tyrese's start to the year was.
Mm-hmm. See, I ask about the Pascal portion in particular because, again, you've already made the line of point about how they're kind of staggering and who they're putting around them. It just feels like such a high-difficulty offensive group.
Yeah.
Which they can afford to do because, you know, TJ McConnell, you mentioned the weird stretch, but generally someone that can operate in tight quarters and will just get 2 feet in the paint whenever he wants. Pascal Siakam has literally made a career and carved out an all-NBA stretch of seasons by being able to operate in those tight quarters. It doesn't bother him as much. I just kind of wonder, are there ways to kind of loosen things up for those two in particular in those units to make them a little bit more fruitful or just to take the pressure off in general?
I mean, some of it's too because of the way some defenses have honestly countered for TJ. Like, to me, one of the worst losses of the year before the in-season tournament break was when they played the Hornets. And if you watch that game back, the Hornets guarded TJ for almost the entirety of the game with Nick Richards. And TJ had his highest scoring game of the year.
30-piece.
But when if TJ gets off the ball, like, it was TJ ball and mainly TJ ball. Because, like, you're not, if TJ passes off the ball to Siakam against that type of coverage, Siakam's just automatically going to be seeing Nick Richards. And when they went up to Boston, it was the same thing, which I don't think is a coincidence given that Charles Lee coached with Joe Mazzulla. Like, they did the same thing with Luke Kornet, and TJ didn't have his best game in that one. So sometimes it does create an interesting dynamic with those particular groupings with what you just said.
Do you worry, don't want to jump ahead too far, do you worry about more teams kind of using that as a template against TJ or just in general, we're just going to put stash our five on insert non-shooter here to kind of muck things up?
Not a lot of teams have tried it. About the only other team that I've seen do that is when the Clippers came to town a year ago. They did some of that with Zubats and the Pacers got creative with it. Like, they started using TJ to run some handoffs at the elbows to try to kind of counter for that. Sometimes they'll even use TJ as the role man. I don't think it's overly concerning, especially because they do have other ball handlers. Like, TJ played his fewest minutes in the first half of that game against Boston. They just went with more Nembhard at the backup guard spot. I don't think there's a lot of teams that are probably going to want to try that. Like, you have to have the right other defenders to be able to cover. Like, Boston has a lot of length, so they can throw other people, you know, at Pascal, at whoever the other bigs are in those groups. So it's not overly concerning, but the teams that are able to accomplish it, it can throw a wrench for a time for those bench lineups in terms of what you're able to run.
I think last thing for me related to the offense, how have you kind of seen Miles Turner's role evolve playing off of and with Tyrese and Pascal this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, when all three of them are right, they can counter almost any pick and roll coverage, because you have Miles Turner in the pick and pop. You have Miles Turner who, if you blitz, Miles can pop to the mid-range area. He is better enough that he can find the opposite corner from that spot. If you're against switch, you have Pascal Siakam. If it's against drop, you have Tyrese's, you know, pull-up shot. You are seeing Miles play around the perimeter more this year. As you put in the notes, he is popping more this year. And I think some of that's related to, at the beginning of the season, Tyrese and Miles' numbers against switch were not as good as what they were a year ago. Some of that was because Tyrese just wasn't making shots against the switch pocket and wasn't creating separation as well. And some of it was because teams were really scramming out Miles Turner, and he was at times leaning on fadeaways in the post. He's been a lot more active against smaller lineups and down low here recently than what he was at the beginning of the year. So then, you know, it was more the Tyrese Siakam combination was more effective against those types of coverages. And like I said, late game, probably the top action they're always going to go to is that wedge roll, which then puts Miles in the weak side corner where you're seeing him be more of the spacer a lot of the time. But the numbers have perked back up between Tyrese and Miles in the pick and roll. They were the number one pick and roll combination in the NBA last year. You've seen them toy with a few things up top in terms of, you know, maybe using pitches a little bit more. They prefer to do that a lot of times. I mean, I probably should have talked about that when we were talking about the pace. Like, something you'll notice that the Pacers really try to avoid is what I call like a long run ball screen. Like, they don't want Miles or Siakam having to come back out of the paint to come set a screen, mm-hmm. because not only does that eat clock, but the screener defender has the whole path all the way up the court to be yelling out the coverage. You use a quick pitch, it's a lot harder to be communicating the coverage going into the screening action. Because what do teams practice more than anything defensively? Pick and roll coverage, right? So yeah. You've seen them tweak a little bit things there. But I mean, it has been a little bit different. I know fans kind of got a little bit frustrated earlier on. And some of the questions I was getting is like, you know, what's happening to Miles? Is this the same thing as like Miles and Sabonis, where they have this post up hub and Pascal Siakam, and it's marginalizing Miles Turner? It's not, I don't find it really comparable, because they're not. Pascal Siakam is not a fulcrum of this offense. The touches for Pascal Siakam are not close to what the touches were for Domantas Sabonis when he was playing under Nate Bjorken, and even under Rick Carlisle when they were lower. Like, I don't find that super comparable. And the two of them, you know, with the way Pascal's shooting the ball, you can be a lot more flexible in the front court to be, you know, picking and choosing what's best against matchups, because Pascal's a much more capable shooter in the corners than what Sabonis was at the time. When he was playing with the Pacers as well, in addition to just what Pascal does defensively at the four spot that Sabonis was not going to be touching when he was playing with the Pacers, at least.
Do they not have a harmony when Pascal's able to punish mismatches and Miles Turner's able to hit shots and Tyrese is driving? That makes it pretty tough, right?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Last night in Detroit, that was like pretty much the meat and potatoes, right? Like, Pascal was pretty much, for whatever reason, the Pistons weren't super interested in doubling when Pascal was getting Tim Hardaway Jr. on the block and was getting Malik Beasley on the block. And they also weren't super interested in coming out to contest Miles Turner from three. So that was kind of the game.
You certainly take that. Go, Steve.
Well, I was going to say, does that take pressure off of Miles Turner to have to be a switch buster to a degree to where you have Pascal?
I think that in part, that's why Miles's defense has been better over the last month to an extent too. If you can lessen some of his responsibility offensively, I think that that allows him to commit more of his energy defensively, because we'll get into it, but Miles had shown some slippage defensively over roughly last year and a half. I think over the month in December, he's been quite good and imposing again.
I think actually we can shift to the defense right there, because that's felt like the story for me over the last month or so, especially as Andrew Nembhard was out, came back, had a small absence, then came back, and now it's just been firmly back in. Again, third in defensive rating, fourth in half-court defense over this 7-1 stretch for them. As what would you say has been the biggest key to them kind of flipping the switch on defense during this run?
Andrew Nembhard getting healthy. That's probably low-hanging fruit. He's always been, in my opinion, he's always been a very good defender. He had special moments even as a rookie. You know, a lot of times we say, you know, rookies are all bad on defense. That wasn't true for Andrew Nembhard. Like, he got a lot of attention when they played the Lakers that year because he made the game winner. What stood out more was the fact that he was guarding LeBron for the majority of that game. And there would literally be possessions where, you know, he's fronting LeBron in the post, doing a post peel on a 45 drive, and then recovering to the opposite corner and contesting Austin Reeves. Like, those were the types of things that once in a while you'd be like, that's going to be a special defender. And now it's all really, you know, coalescing at the same time. It's not the only change that's been made. There's other things defensively that have happened and coincided with Andrew Nembhard getting off that minutes restriction and getting back. But it starts with him. And you could see that last night. I don't know if you guys watched the game against the Pistons, but he's on Cade Cunningham. And I liken Andrew Nembhard a lot of times to an itchy sweater. He's very hard to peel off. And if you do, the stuff around him is, the help is more prevalent. So it wasn't just Andrew Nembhard against Cade last night. It was the fact that they were more active. When they played the Pistons in the opener, there's three possessions in a row where Cade Cunningham walked Andrew Nembhard and Aaron Nesmith into the post and turned over his strong shoulder. And this game, it's like that's starting to happen. Jairus Walker's doubling from the top side. Like, that help is there. If Cade slides to the post out of a wedge roll, Andrew's fronting it. Miles is, you know, at the midline, ready to protect and provide help. The rotations are in place when Cade passes out of it. In the fourth quarter, you could see Andrew's getting, he's getting worn down. He's been picking the ball up full court against Cade Cunningham this entire game. And Miles Turner's there, is mixing in some blitzes, not letting Cade turn around the edge of the blitz. And he's also there, you know, rotating and providing help, getting that volleyball style block. And at the same time, you got Pascal Siakam, who's really providing a shadow presence on a lot of the pick and roll, a lot of the zoom actions, to the point where in the first quarter, you could literally hear Pascal through the broadcast. He got called for a defensive 3 seconds calls. And he's like, yo, I was out. I was not in there. But like, this is the point. Like, by comparison to last season, how often Pascal is in there and actually does need to cleanse and step out. You always have, you know, an extra goalie a lot of times behind Miles playing up at the level as well. So that was kind of like a microcosm, the way that the team defended Cade Cunningham. Andrew Nembhard, very, very important. He's the first player there, the most important guy, but he's getting a lot of support from the pieces around him that wasn't necessarily there at the beginning of the year and especially last season.
I don't want to take it off Andrew Nembhard, but I do have a question based on what you said. Because one of the things I've liked about this stretch from Indiana's defense is their base feels more solid, their help feels more present, but it also feels smarter. Like, they feel in control of the rotations they want to make. They feel like they're in early. They feel like they're on a string. Like, even that first play of that Detroit game, right? They try and sneak Tyrese like a double drag. He jumps it. He tries to recover, gets beat on the closeout. But Pascal takes the drive. Tyrese tries to get back to the corner. I'm like, these are the efforts they're making every single night. So how have you felt about a team that didn't always love to be in rotation, being able to rotate this well at this point?
I think that the 4 days of that break of the in-season tournament should have novels written about it on how exactly they accomplished this degree of cohesiveness and just the overall effort level and competitive spirit to be that connected and tied together, and what the communication level has been. Because that possession you just mentioned is a great example. Because, you know, finding that role for Pascal Siakam didn't come easily. When he first got traded over here, there was a conditioning aspect to it. Certainly there was, this defense is way different than anything I ever did in Toronto. And quite frankly, the defense the Pacers were playing last year was quite different, I think, for most players on the roster. But it went from, you know, let's see if Pascal can be imposing at the point of attack against Devin Booker. Oh, no, we don't like that. You know, let's see if he can play some at the five and maybe do some switching. No, we don't really like that. Like, let's put him on the top, opposing top wing threats. And it's like, okay, he barely does that because he's too important offensively to what you saw some in the playoffs where it's like, oh, you know, kind of really like seeing what he can do when he's all the way off of Precious Achiuwa and Josh Hart. And he's more, you know, he's lost a step, but if he can use the right angles and be smart where he's providing the help, like, it's been a big difference maker. And that's why for a big portion of the season, he was, you know, before Andrew Nembhard came back, their most impactful on-off defensive player because of what you're just mentioning there. And also, I like what you said about, you know, Tyrese kind of giving up that back cut and peeling to the corner. When you are providing more help and the help rate is higher, Tyrese still has his limitations as a defender. I'm not going to paper or gloss that over. But some of the things that he does well show up more when you're providing help and he's able to rotate around and fly into passing lanes a little bit more. But like, you're seeing, like, he has a very good contest rate. He's blocked a lot of threes, second to only Matisse Thybulle since his first full season with the Pacers. Like, you get to block more threes when you're closing out more. Last year, the Pacers had the lowest closeout rate in the NBA. They had the lowest rate of help in the NBA. And some of that, like, I give them credit for, get you guys' opinion. I've kind of looked back on that. And I remember saying when I was on the podcast last year, I was like, you know, the charitable way I think of looking at this defense is you're hoping that you're building better habits and that by removing some of the help, they'll improve their on-ball defense enough that you're seeing the long-term benefits. And maybe, you know, maybe that is the scheme that you run when you think you're going to be a rebuilding team and you want to take away some of the peel switching and some of those other aspects because they thought, you know, at the time, like, we think that that leads to some complacency with getting beat. We want to take that away so that people, you know, for lack of a better term, take more pride in defending the basketball. Now the peel switching is back and you're seeing, you know, quite a bit of urgency, like you said, for Tyrese to be peeling off and getting out to that corner. So it's kind of like finding a happy middle and blending the two. It's not the highest help rate in the NBA, but it's higher than last year, and you're seeing it be a lot more cohesive, where maybe they did reap, while the defense did not itself be very effective last year with what they were doing, maybe that in and of itself, in terms of building some of the habits and the competitive level on ball, is making what they're doing now work a little bit better.
I think the compete level stands out, and it's like when you watch them, I try and like watch their shell to a degree. And I feel like their bodies are always in the same spots. They're always ready to help, but they will not overcommit. So yes, there is someone at the elbow, but if I don't have to take this away, I'm going to stay with mine and we're going to work to try and keep the ball in front, or someone's going to help late. And I feel like those little subtle things of what help them, because you see like more activity in off ball actions, more activity as far as pressuring the ball or pushing, you know, pick and roll out. I feel like cleaner switches at times, although that can get a little tricky. But it's been fun to watch them grow into that as opposed to, gee, I hope they're going to be solid, you know?
I think just to bounce off of what both of you have said, like the fact that the base is stronger has allowed them to kind of mix and match to this degree. And I think ultimately they wanted to get to a point where, one, they just want their defense to be fine because like the offense is going to lead the dance for them, just thinking of them as a theory. So you want to get the defense to, I think the thing we said last year is like, hey, if they're going to be an elite offense, can they get to like 16th, 17th to kind of carry the rest of the way? And so that you feel comfortable with your base, you're bringing in more help and you're nailing the rotations with that. That allows you to, if we are going to have Thomas Bryant in the drop, they've had him up quite a bit. But in general, if you're going to have him in the drop, you're going to have Miles Turner in the drop. We trust if we sprinkle in this extra nail help, we're going to thwart this drive. And if we don't, we can rotate behind that if necessary. And like one of the things that has been interesting for me, like as they've had Thomas at the level, as they've had Miles Turner at the level, is just how well they've been able to kind of build their base or build their rotations around that. Like it hasn't felt as dire as it did in some points last year, to where if Miles is up and he gets beat, who do we have down there? Even if Pascal is in, to your point, is he actually in and ready to rotate down the rim? Are they ready to rotate behind him? That feeling more consistent, I think, has been huge. And I think back to, you know, again, sticking with Thomas Bryant, even Tyrese, an example I brought up on the pod earlier this week in that Cleveland game where they're going Caris LeVert, kind of a fake pick and roll to Evan Mobley. They swing it to him. Now it's Max Strus screening for Evan Mobley to kind of go inverted. Tyrese jumps it. Evan Mobley has to retreat. Evan tries to attack. And I think it's Ben Shepherd that quickly digs down to kind of disrupt Evan Mobley on that drive. And I don't know how Evan Mobley ended up making this twisting floater off glass. He's just that good. But it's just like, okay, this is a lot different than Indiana just being very committed, I'll say, to defending things 2-on-2 and whatever happens, happens. And so just seeing them kind of move on a string to that degree, as you've said, as Steve said, it's been impressive to me. And then circling back a little bit earlier, the full court pressure has just been fun. Andrew, going back to that Pistons game, Andrew Nembhard just picking the pocket of Cade Cunningham multiple times, just bothering him, made basket, Cade gets the inbound, here's Andrew Nembhard. That just has to be annoying for if nothing else. But I guess I do have a question about just the general wear and tear of it all, because that's always in the back of my head with teams like Indiana and others that have ramped up their full court pressure, like something that Steve and I talked about early in the year, is that the full court pickups are just up league-wide this year. How do the Pacers kind of balance that kind of, you know, backcourt pressure on top of the pace that they want to play with offensively and try to, I guess, like manage, I guess, just the general fatigue of the team as they obviously want to make another deep playoff run?
Yeah, I mean, this is an exhausting brand of basketball for the teams that they play against and for themselves, right? I talked about this briefly because people have been talking about the ball pressure a lot. And in the playoffs, the Pacers, by synergy standpoints and what they track as press, the Pacers played more possessions of press during that playoff run than any team in synergy's database. And they maintained their pace of play. And that was pretty much team-wide. Like, sometimes to my consternation when they were playing Boston, it's like, you really need Obi Toppin breaking up Drew Holiday full court. I'm not sure we fully do. And sometimes with Pascal too, but Pascal's had some, you know, pretty impressive possessions picking up full court as well. I think that the way that they do this is because, like, right now, which I'm sure we might talk about a little bit later, Aaron Nesmith comes back for the first time last night against Detroit. It just so happens that Benedict Mathurin was suspended, but if Benedict Mathurin hadn't been suspended, like, there are some conversations here about, you know, who is playing, who isn't playing. Like, what does this mean for Jairus Walker's minutes potentially? What does it mean for Ben Shepherd's minutes? They're deep enough where their depth really feeds their play style. Like, look what their minutes totals are. Like, this is something that Pascal's talked about, that coming over from Indiana after playing such high minutes loads under Nick Nurse and what that defensive scheme was for Nick Nurse, that they're protective of what Tyrese does. I mean, of what Siakam does to keep that under control. So I think because they have as many rotation players, it allows them to do what they do probably a little bit better than what some other teams who might want to try to execute the same thing will be able to do over the long term of the season. And also, like, a big part of this, which, I mean, I probably should have said when we were talking about the defense, you know, in certain extent, there's only one end of the floor. A big part of their ball pressure has been predicated on the fact that this team is barely turning the ball over. Like, they have the lowest turnover rate in the NBA by, like, a pretty wide margin since that, you know, four-game layover. And some of that's by refining spacing principles. Some of that's by getting some of those rotation guys like Andrew Nembhard and Ben Shepherd back so they weren't having to play as many units with, like, and no offense to these players, I think that they did some good things when they're playing. But when you're having to play, you know, lineups with multiple, you know, Quentin Jackson, Enrique Freeman, young rookies or young, you know, G League players at the same time, that was leading to their turnover rates being higher. And also just, like, you know, some basic things like, hey, maybe yell out when somebody's pressing the ball and do a little bit of communicating about, you know, look where you're throwing an outlet pass to, when they had like 12 turnovers in a quarter in Brooklyn prior to when that break was. So that's allowed them to apply that ball pressure more. You know, when you're not turning the ball over and having to stop on a dime and get back as much as they were, and you're forcing more stops and you yourselves are making more shots, you can pick up easier than what was capable before that.
It's a quality feedback loop. Also, shout out to the not-so-controlled aggression of Quentin Jackson. Always a ball of energy, we'll put it that way.
You mean you shouldn't help one pass away off of Anthony Simons? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I don't think so. Hey, Steve, the Keyshawn George possession against Devin Booker last night.
Okay, do we have to talk? Look, man. Look, man. Don't help off the corner if you don't need the help. Don't help if you don't need the help. Please, for the love of God, any young basketball player out there, be in help early. That's fantastic. Once you've done your job, you just go back towards yours. You don't have to stay there. Because the man left Devin Booker open in the corner for no reason. It was a switch.
The combination of Keyshawn George draining like a 30-footer late in the shot clock to bring that game to three and then immediately giving the three right back up. But that help off with that Booker kills me. But circling back to the Pacers, I guess I want to talk about this more through the defense lens, but honestly, we can just make this a full-blown conversation with you, Caitlin, as you've recently written about this as well. Where are you with the Pacers' relationship to zone as a concept?
Which end of the floor?
Yes.
Defensively, I like that they mixed it in, and it was something that I brought up several times over the summer. Before I knew this level of cohesiveness was possible, and before I knew what some of the tweaks were going to be made, and the main reason that I brought it up, which you'll see them do a lot, is they put Tyrese at the bottom of the zone. And I liked it for that feature alone, because, like, when they played Dallas early in the year, for instance, you know, Tyrese, maybe he gets hunted by Luka Doncic a few possessions in a row. Maybe that doesn't go particularly well. Okay, we're going to go to zone just for, you know, maybe one or two possessions, put him at the bottom. Maybe Dallas isn't ready for that. Certainly you could run some zone busters to get at Tyrese if you wanted to. But a lot of times you'll see that teams aren't super prepared for it. So if nothing else, Tyrese isn't showing 30 feet from the basket, you know, having that energy outload and then having to recover somewhere else when you're playing it. And I'm not saying that zone's an opportunity for your defense as a whole to relax. I don't want to, you know, start that narrative. But just to provide a simple break from, you know, some of the times when we were seen in the playoffs when Tyrese is being hunted by the New York Knicks while he's guarding Deuce McBride, you know, 20 times in a basketball game, that's, you know, and having to show that many times, that's a tiring thing to do. So I was in favor of them doing it for that reason. And also, you know, for them as a rebounding team, there's certainly a balance with it. Because when you're in zone, statistically, teams do give up more offensive rebounds typically when they're playing zone than when they are in man. So would that exacerbate some of their rebounding issues? They've been, you know, okay rebounding recently for the most part. So every so many games, they're probably still going to have one where Rick Carlisle is going to come out afterwards and be like, we got to get the rebounds. We got to be better on the glass. We got to win the aggression stats. You know, you're still probably going to hear that type of stuff. But for that reason alone, defensively, I wanted them to implement it as a changeup. And I think that it has been beneficial to them at times. They're pretty aggressive trying to take away. Like, you'll see Pascal's pretty good when he plays at the bottom, taking away the extra pass to the corner and making sure his body is there on the bump outs and the bump down to get there. It's not always perfect. I wouldn't say that the rotations and flight on the ball are always really fleshed out, but I like that they do it. Offensively, it's been problematic this year for them to play against zone. I'm sure you guys have seen that in games.
Yeah, it's I guess the thing that's intrigued me about the Pacers offensively against zone, like, it really does just depend on the night you catch them on.
Yeah. It's been feast or famine. We've seen,
yeah, like, I think it was because they had the 2-game set against Miami. I'm trying to remember if it was the first game or the second game where they just kind of diced up Miami zone for like an entire half. It's like, well, you can't, I guess you just can't do this now. I want to say it's the second game as they got the win there. But then you will have other matchups where it just feels like we're moving this to the middle. Okay, what's happening next? Okay, we've got on the perimeter. Okay, here's this high screen. Are we generating anything? Okay, this is a late clock shot. Or this is the very first opening we see, we are taking the shot. And it did not go down. Now we're back in transition and we're trying to match up. We're trying to figure out what we need to do here. It's been, to your point, it's been very feast or famine. Like, do you think that is just, is it a shot quality deal? Is it a processing speed deal for them against the zone? Is it just the randomness of when they're seeing it?
I think that the first thing that probably needs to be discussed is why are teams doing it? So the Pacers have been zoned against more than any team in the NBA. They faced 223 possessions of zone, according to Second Spectrum. Just on a frequency standpoint, it's over 5%, which is the highest of any team in the league. I think the main reasons for that are the pace. Sometimes teams want to slow it down. If they can get, you know, if they can score and get back in the zone, then you're not facing the Pacers in transition as much, especially since the Pacers are a team that likes to still push the pace off of makes as well as misses. That's probably the main reason. Another reason, this is not a high shooting, catch and shoot 3-point attempt team. They're pretty low in that regard. They don't have a lot of quick trigger shooters, and they're also very high in the fact that their percentage of touches featuring a paint touch is a lot of the ways that they predicate their offense. So zone's going to be pretty effective against all of those things in terms of slowing down pace, in terms of, hey, we don't have to worry about a lot of quick trigger 3-point shooters if we give that up on the perimeter. And, oh, we might prevent you from being able to get in the paint. And a lot of times, the first time you would see teams going zone is a lot of times when TJ comes into the game. You know, TJ is not a shooter, and TJ's also got like the highest drive rate in the NBA per 100 possessions. So that's kind of a portion when you'll see it. And also, like, the three games that I think kind of explain the story that you just talked about, they played the Milwaukee Bucks. They were up 19 points, and they gave up that lead predominantly because Milwaukee went to the zone and they struggled to score against it. I think Milwaukee at the time, that was like one of the third highest zone rates in a game this year. Then they went to Miami, which is the game that you referenced, and they put in a new zone buster, which, fun backstory, I found out from somebody in Portland because I wrote about the zone buster, which basically just provide a visual, like, you can imagine Miles Turner or Thomas Bryant standing in the high post. The other four players are going to rotate around it like you're, you know, turning a dial multiple times where they're trying to, you know, overload it. Ultimately, the end game of that is you're going to get an angled ball screen, hopefully with Tyrese dribbling towards two with that in motion. So the other top defender has to commit to him on a switch, and then you're getting that 2-on-1. Apparently, Terry Stotts saw the Greek national team run this clear back in 2010, put it in with the Mavericks when Rick Carlisle was still there. And then Terry Stotts was running it in Portland, and Rick Carlisle was like, you know what? Before we play the Miami Heat, I got this play in my bag. And it came out and they ran it. They ran it well enough that Miami did not run any zone in the second half of that game. I was like, we've turned a corner here. This is looking better. There's motion. Like, the motion, at the very least, if you don't have a lot of quick trigger shooters, was forcing defenders to have to point and communicate about where they were going to be. Then they played the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Cavs played 37 possessions of zone in the second game of that miniseries. That's the most the Pacers have faced in a game this year. Difference being is Evan Mobley played really far back in that zone and wasn't committing to the high post. So some of that's like when you make shots, it looks good. When you miss shots, it looks bad. But also the Pacers were taking the shots that the zone wanted them to take. So they shot like 12% on mid-range twos, on like 8 mid-range twos against that zone. Thomas Bryant looked very like glitchy in the middle of it. Like he didn't quite know what to do with the ball in space. Miles Turner is capable of making those shots. He just missed one. Andrew Nembhard's capable of flashing there and making some of those shots. He missed some of them. But also the big question mark here, which I'll get you guys' thoughts on, rarely do they put Pascal Siakam in the middle of the zone. Despite what he is as a mid-range creator, his attacking mentality, he can play make some with odd man advantages. He doesn't do that. So I can understand it to an extent. My guess is the thought process there is, hey, we like this motion action. And if we put Pascal Siakam in the middle, it doesn't, like, what exactly are Miles and Thomas Bryant going to be doing, you know, as a threatening force if you're turning the dial with them on the perimeter versus Pascal's a lot more threatening from the corners. He can do a little bit more if he catches the ball on the move. But on the whole, I've looked this up. I've tracked it. Pascal Siakam has 5 passes that he's received in the paint against zone coverage all year. And he's been on the floor for a lot of this. So Kenny Atkinson talked about it. Like Pascal had 21 points in the first half of the game against Cleveland. Cleveland plays a ton of zone in the second half. He had 2 points. So like, what are your thoughts about playing Pascal in the middle, why they might not be playing Pascal in the middle?
I think for me is what you said. My initial thought was going to be, if you want to poke at, you know, weaker defenders at the bottom of zones, like Pascal is more equipped to do that than I think Miles. Like, I think Miles has shown really just a flash over the last 2 or 3 years, just as him as a driver. But I don't know how I feel about him dealing with like shifting and digging bodies against the zone in particular. Like, I don't know if the handle's quite tight enough for you to trust those kind of drives. So I think Pascal more equipped to deal with some of the help that he may see if he does try to poke at a matchup. And in general, like if Miles is going to shoot as well as he is from deep, if Thomas Bryant, he's just going to be more comfortable taking a catch to shoot three if he's stationed at the wing or something after the defense rotates or after they rotate against the zone, more than him trying to attack off the bounce. That's just not his ministry. So I think it's just a comfort deal for Pascal there. I do agree with you. They could still find a way to get more than 5.
5 but passes to understand. Him in the paint against zone.
Yeah, like I think there's room for a little bit more than 5, but I do understand conceptually, we know you're good in the middle of the floor. Also, you are better at getting to the middle of the floor than the other options there.
I think, is there a world where if he's near the top or near the middle, he also gets some of those matchups anyways? More than attacking the bottom defenders?
They can, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I think one thing, like not to interrupt, but one thing I would have liked is if he's in the middle against Cleveland's zone and Cleveland's playing 2 bigs, like if Allen and Mobley are both out there, Pascal's going to be more apt to actually force Mobley to commit and dribble. And if you had played like Miles in the dunker on Jarrett Allen's side of the floor, then at least Jarrett Allen's having to make a choice between like, am I staying with Miles? Am I going to the guy in the corner? But like rarely is Pascal the guy playing in the middle. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you're good. And I think the one issue or the one thing that you kind of felt in that game, even as they were going to spinning the dial and Thomas Bryant was hoping he could find someone to screen, Cleveland was like, oh, we're just matched up. We're fine. There are people here. So I think you probably want to mix Pascal. To your point, he becomes a threat and you have to commit to it as opposed to feeling comfortable. You got to make a zone feel uncomfortable. I feel like if you don't move Pascal around, they sort of get into that rhythm of funnel, drive, kick, will rotate, et cetera, et cetera.
Some of the ball screen stuff might have worked better too, because the difference between Miami and Cleveland is Miami was a little bit caught off guard from it. I'm sure Cleveland probably watched some of the film of what the Pacers did against Miami's zone, perhaps, but they were just ducking under TJ. Like Tyrese didn't play in the second game. So when that ball screen came, they were just like, Karis was like, oh, I'll just go under it. And then the other top defender wasn't having to commit to the ball. So you weren't getting that same odd man advantage. So some little things like that, you know, maybe if Tyrese is available the next time they play Cleveland, it might look a little bit different. But on the whole, the fact that like Siakam, typically when the teams go zone, Siakam's involvement becomes significantly less. So I don't think it was a coincidence that he went from having 20 points at halftime to only getting 2 in the second half.
I feel like that's probably encouraging in a way. Like, it's weird. I think there, as we all kind of argued, there's room for more involvement. That also just feels like low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine if you do get into a playoff setting against a team that's more willing to go zone, now you just have all these Pascal usage reps in the back pocket that you can add on to what you're already doing. And then maybe zone just becomes less of a tenable option for defenses. But obviously you want to see that in the regular season. Like, five is such a stark number on that front.
Good, you know, gracious. There might be a little bit of tracking wonkiness there where maybe his 2 feet are slightly outside the paint, but like actually inside the paint. Yeah, it's five.
That is nuts. But yeah, I think there's room for a little bit more Pascal in that regard. I'm trying to think, is there anything else related to the defense that we haven't touched on yet? The zone's been cool. The rotations, just more help, more rotations as just kind of pops off the screen.
Are we talking about Indiana's zone defense?
I guess just the defense at large.
I like their zone defense. They have some subtle rotations within it.
I like that sometimes they're willing to, like, they'll go man. Like, if somebody flashes to the high post, sometimes they'll be like, we're in a man and we're okay flipping, or we're in a zone and we're okay flipping this to man now. And then sometimes we're okay going to a switch now. Like, I've seen them mm-hmm. do all three on the same possession and really kind of fluidly go from one to the next.
Did you think they would be able to execute it at that type of level?
Absolutely not. Like, people know, like, there was a podcast. There is a podcast of me during that break where I was like, you know, the most concerning thing right now is the effort level. And, you know, Samson Folk and I talked about this on our podcast where he was like, sometimes that's the easiest thing to fix and sometimes that's the hardest thing to fix. And it, sometimes, like what Nikias just said, it's like, okay, maybe this is encouraging because if you fix the effort, this could get better. But as far as their overall, you know, like we've talked about, the cohesiveness, the communication, and just patching for as many, like something we probably could have talked about is that you are actually noticing Benedict Mathurin and Jairus Walker for things that they are doing well on defense instead of me noticing Benedict Mathurin for things that he's doing wrong consistently on defense. Like, the two of them have made some contributions. I'm not going to say that they're the top two defenders consistently on the team, but I have seen progress from the two of them where there are times where I'll be like, hey, that is something there. But to my point about my wrongness, I said on the podcast, like, I'm not convinced that this is going to be a considerably better defense. And then lo and behold, they come back. Andrew Nembhard's healthy. A lot of these other things coalesce at the same time. And here we are sitting about talking about a team that's, you know, my goal for them was like, if they can get to 18th, I think that they're doing pretty well if the offense can maintain. And over the stretch, you know, they've been, you know, close to top 10, if not better.
Ah, so what? You had the eyes of, I thought you were about to say something, Steve. My apologies.
No.
I guess, okay. All right. Well, actually, we can stay right there with Benedict Mathurin, which is some of the young guys in general. We can start with Mathurin. You've already mentioned the defense. I'll start there with you, Caitlin. Like, what strides have you seen from Benedict Mathurin defensively this year?
I mean, I'll say that, I mean, people can go look at the numbers. And when we're talking about Andrew Nembhard's impact, this team literally goes from, like, the equivalent of a top-ranked defense when Andrew's out there with the other four starters to when Andrew isn't out there with the other four starters, they're giving up like 119 points per 100. So Andrew's papering over quite a bit still. Like, if you look at Tyrese and Ben's net rating, they are finally above sea level, which is good because over the first 2 years, like, aggregately, they had not been. And over the early portion of the season, they had not been because stylistically, they are quite different. Obviously, Tyrese was going through some of his stuff. And then defensively, it was not viable. Andrew comes back and it does look viable, but also Ben is making some quiet contributions where he's definitely improved as a rebounder. That pops off the most mm-hmm. where he's making a more consistent effort to be boxing out even if he doesn't get the rebound. And then I'm like watching possessions in Sacramento where suddenly, you know, he can high point and battle DeMontis Sabonis and somehow come up with a rebound. Like, these are not things I was seeing a year ago. And then also, like, in the Cleveland game before he got ejected, like, you're seeing possessions where, hey, he's actually making the veer switch rotation and getting a deflection away from Jarrett Allen and then blocking and staying vertical against Okoro on the same possession. And then, you know, providing a last line of defense in transition defensively. There's still mistakes. You're still going to see stuff. Like, I don't really want Ben doing the things that Andrew is doing defensively. And Ben isn't going to provide, you know, the same amount of, because another thing about Andrew that we really didn't talk about is in addition to what he does as an itchy sweater, he's also their best off-ball defender. He's their highest field defender. In terms yeah. of what they do with peel switching and other things. Like, you're not going to say that about Ben, but I have noticed more positives from him than what I had seen over the first 2 years with him defensively.
Okay, like that's something I wanted to mention, like during the zone portion, like having Benedict Mathurin step up as a rebounder, Aaron Nesmith isn't afraid to mix it up with bigger bodies. TJ McConnell, even Tyrese, they aren't afraid to kind of mix it up in there. Like, I think there is a gang rebounding element to them in general. And with the zone, that could make that a little bit more tenable as it moves forward. So I like that about Ben. And Jairus Walker, like, one, Jairus Walker getting somewhat consistent minutes just feels like a story in and of itself this year. Like, is that just a product of, you know, having another training camp, et cetera, some of the injuries they had dealt with, or what kind of strides have you seen from Jairus this year to kind of earn that kind of playing time?
I thought that his game against Cleveland that they won was the best game of his career so far, and it's not going to show on the box score. It wasn't because he piled up points. And I think Rick's kind of talked about this. It's not about pretty plays and pretty passing with him. It's about, you know, what he's doing defensively, because that's really what they were missing. So in that game, it really suited him, because he got to be that event creator. We know how good his hand-eye coordination, his cat-like reflexes with his hands are. He was very active stalking the nail in that game. And Cleveland was consistently, you know, moving the ball to the two-player side of the floor, which allowed him to be doing some of that. Now, when they came back to Indiana, Cleveland had made some adjustments to be like, hey, you know what? We weren't getting downhill as much, because they were providing, you know, really early, you know, whether it was nexting, whether it was digging, whether it was just, you know, Jairus's hands poking from behind, like, we're going to avoid some of that. So now the pick and roll was more so going toward the single side of the floor. They were running some flat pick and rolls for Darius Garland. So Jairus wasn't having quite that same impact. And then you're kind of seeing like, oh, you know, he just gave up a strong hand, straight line drive to Donovan Mitchell. And on the possession before that, he missed the low man rotation and just kind of getting a little bit of a talking to from Pascal Siakam. And then they take a timeout and he's not on the floor. And you probably saw some of that last night in Detroit too, right? Like in the fourth quarter, he made a tremendous play against Tim Hardaway Jr. where he like kind of absorbed a bump and then got a block. He also stole a pass up at the top and got that, you know, finished at the rim with the pick six. And then there's two possessions where this is the thing that stands out a lot about Jairus, is he can still be very casual, which wasn't something that I necessarily expected during the pre-draft process, but you know, you're in the fourth quarter of a game against Detroit. You kind of want to get a tiebreaker as well as just, you know, win a basketball game. And he has Andrew and Tyrese to his left side and throws a pass across his body with his left hand straight out of bounds. And then on the next defensive possession, he wasn't ready to guard and he ends up losing. I believe it's Malik Beasley gets ahead of him and he has to grab from behind and gets a foul. And then that was it. It's like, okay, we're going to close with Ben Shepherd now. And like sometimes up in Boston too, you see that, right? Like they didn't close with Ben or Jairus. They closed with Ben Shepherd guarding Jason Tatum and Andrew guarding Jaylen Brown. So there's still some things like that you're going to notice. Like Jairus's physical tools and the things that he can do. I think that the way that I termed it in the article I wrote the other day is he's starting to figure it out, but he's still figuring it out, I think is the way that I would put it. Like you can see there's some tantalizing stuff going on, but there's also still going to be some of these slip ups and a thing that Rick Carlisle and the coaching staff will talk about a lot with him is they want him to play to the point of exhaustion. They want him to be playing with a consistently high motor. And sometimes that still waxes and wanes a little bit. Mm.
And I just as a fan of his, like I want him to nail that portion. Like First and foremost, that will just help the Pacers because of the intersection of size and skill that he has. But like the fun with Jairus when he's locked in, you already mentioned the event creation defensively. Like he's also put together some really fun clips on film offensively with some of the self-created stuff that he can do. If he nails enough of the little things, I would imagine he gets a little more freedom to explore with the ball in his hands.
Yeah.
And then Indiana can invert some things for him, let him get attacked. He shot well this year. I want him to nail this because that just unlocks a level of lineup versatility for Indiana, just general versatility of the different things they can run, different defenses they can tap into. I like Jairus, and so it's been cool seeing him get this opportunity. But to your point, he has to nail it consistently. The possession by possession stuff has to be there.
That possession in the fourth quarter against Cleveland, when Andrew was pressuring the ball and Jairus switched, and then Andrew had to navigate a flare screen, next it on the pick and roll, and Jairus filtered out to the weak side and basically like volleyball set it and deflected it. I was like, this is what I've been dreaming about. Do you know how many times I was hoping I could write about a possession like this? It's happened. We are here.
This is what he could do. Steve, how have you felt about the Jarius experience?
I felt fine. I think for me at times a little surprised at the amount of rope he got, considering who the coach is. But then I also realized the effort that he gives and what he can bring to the table on both ends of the floor. And the funniest part about that play is I remember the camera pan to Coach Carlisle after Jarius threw that left hand pass. And I was like, oh no. Because there were two assistant coaches that started clapping immediately. And that man was not pleased though. So I think there's like a give and take because he's done. I think he's done his job. I think he's getting better at doing the little things that will allow you to have more time overall. But he's got to continue to get there. And I think that's going to be the interesting part. Where does he necessarily land? I'm not necessarily sure like what his role every night would be. Like, what does he do every single night? That's not a bad thing. Yeah. But you kind of have to mold it around what the Pacers are doing because you have the moments, as Caitlin said, where it pops. The transition's there. The defense is there. The help is there. Like, I've liked some of the weak side moments during this stretch where he's on the weak side. You can tell he's aware of what's happening. He knows what rotation he has to make or what's about to happen. That's the kind of stuff that gets you more minutes. So that's been fun to see from him. But, you know, it's been a good season for him.
And that's what I like. Like, he's not always known as being the most connected defender, hence why, like, Pascal's looking at him and, like clapping, being like, you know, come on now. But, like, that's – if he figures that out, that's what role I think I like for him the most, as an event creator, helping at the nail, hanging out in tall grass along the baseline. Like, I like that better than the idea – while he does have some impressive possessions against, you know, like, having more linked against Jalen Brunson in the fourth quarter, some of what he did – even just in garbage time against Jaylen Brown when they had the poorer game of the two-game miniseries against Boston, I'm not so convinced of his on-ball stopping qualities all the time. Hence, you know, what happened against Donovan Mitchell and what led to him coming out. But which does bring up an interesting question. As much as I'm impressed by what strides they've taken defensively, I still don't know how viable I think it is when you get to an end of a game against Boston and Ben Shepherd needs to guard Jason Tatum. That's the same spot that they were in the Eastern Conference Finals when it's like, okay, it wasn't Ben Shepherd, but it was Aaron Nesmith and you are giving up size here. Like, I still don't know against certain teams if they get into the postseason, like if I feel strongly that they have a wing defender with size that they can definitively rely on in those moments.
I think quickly on the Ben Shepherd front, like he has had to defend a lot of different types of people. Yeah. Like it's very much for like, hey, if we don't have Nembhard, you kind of need to be Nembhard.
Yep.
And I kind of feel for him in that regard. It does feel like he's overtasked sometimes, but he's game. Like we talked about Jarius and sometimes it could be a little bit lax. I don't feel that with Ben Shepherd at all. He's willing to do whatever, I guess sticking with the forward room, this has been yet another effective or at least efficient season for Obi Toppin. And I'll start with the defense. How have you felt about the Obi defense this year? Have you seen meaningful improvement from last season?
At times, yes. Consistently, like maybe not. Like, I mean, like last night, Detroit, there's a possession where, like I said, if I was a team and I wanted to thwart the Pacers ball pressure, if I had anybody at those spots, like what Boston's capable of doing, like if Pascal and Obi are going to guard Drew Holiday, like if Obi's going to guard a ball handler, I'd be like, okay, you're just going to bring the ball up the floor, even if it means that we get into action with somebody else, because like Obi makes an effort there, but like once he gets beat, and then if you go into a 4-5 pick and roll, that's a pretty effective counter against the defense. I'd feel comfortable with that. So, I mean, I think Obi has some physical limitations that are always going to put somewhat of a ceiling on what he can do, especially by comparison to Jarius. Like, he just doesn't have the flexibility to be able to do some of the stuff that Jarius can bring and do for you. Obi's very good at running in straight lines. He's very angular. He's not very good at having to change direction, specifically against the switch, specifically with some of his help coverages. So, the one thing that stands out the most about Obi is that early on, I wrote a piece where I was like, you know, he, in a way, is kind of the bellwether of their play style. Like, when they weren't playing to their identity, when they weren't playing as fast, there was a number of games where he hadn't made a three and he hadn't scored in transition. It's like, you're not going to win those minutes. and they weren't winning those minutes. And that's why he had like the worst, you know, per cleaning the glass net rating on the team for a long portion. And it's like, okay, once they rediscovered that and his three started falling again, it's like, oh, he can be a pretty valuable player. So like, I still like him as a bench four role. And I think that he does add and build out what they do, but I won't necessarily say that he addresses their weaknesses. Although I know that he has made effort in those areas, and especially on the glass at times where they have, tried to get him to realize, like, you are so fast, you can stay and box out. Like, you don't always have to leak out and get to the other end of the floor where there's been a little bit more emphasis there as well.
Like, I think for me, it's, I guess, still trying to figure out, like, what Ovi's best coverage is.
Yeah.
Because, like, early on in his career, early in the Pacers stint, like, my thing with him was more, like, there is just the general, how quickly can he flip his hips and slide? But like, I was a lot very worried, particularly in the New York stretch before the Indy stretch, but just what it looked like with him off ball and just the instincts there. And it felt like that portion has gotten better. But when he is directly involved, like you've mentioned some of the issues with switching, the at the level stuff for him and just the Pacer bigs at large have been interesting to me, because you have the, we're at the level and we're dropping back. We're actually just going to creep all the way up here and maybe a little bit step higher to make sure that you just can't get across, and that either turns into a switch or a full out blitz. And the recovery from those types of coverages is where I get kind of lost with Obi. Cause like, he's up there and he's there on time, and he does make an effort to legit like impact the ball when he's there. He flashes the hands. He does try to angle his body in a way to make sure you can't drive by him. If his guy goes, he's grabbing, trying to turn around, stay attached. He's trying to throw the arm up to make sure you can't get a pass there, but he doesn't feel like he's super aware of like where that pass would actually come. And like, that part is where it gets dicey. And I just wonder, like, can he make enough strides there to where he can, I guess, remain feasible as we talk about the playoff rotation in a little bit, but just what that's going to look like for him?
I think it would probably be similar to last year in that, you know, when it's Obi at the five, it's more about, we think we're going to be able to outscore that opponent. Like, I mean, that's generally what it was. Like, they're playing Milwaukee. If Milwaukee's going to go small with Bobby Portis or small with Danilo Gallinari, they're like, we think we can play small better than you with Obi Toppin. Like, let's be honest now. Like, if they felt super good about what Obi Toppin was doing at the level of a screen, do they go and trade for Thomas Bryant? Like, yeah, you need depth, but like, this was, we're not really surviving the Obi at the 5 minutes well enough where we feel that we don't need to go trade for another big, or we don't need to at least take a flyer on the very short-lived Moses Brown experience. Like, still don't know what hand Moses Brown shoots with.
I just, Steve and I have talked about this quite a bit. It's just, Moses, for him to have the limp that he does, like, he just doesn't really use his arms. And I don't understand how you have that kind of size and that kind of length. And you, I don't know. This goes back to like the OKC days for me. It's like, there's clearly talent there.
To me, but he uses just, like, wild arm activity. Like, at times it was like watching a windmill to compensate for the fact that he can't backpedal.
Mm-hmm. That's the issue right there.
It's been a battle of extremes for Moses Brown. But that would explain why the experiment is no longer taking place.
Also, Nakai, it's very slick of you to transfer your Thomas Bryant defense concerns to Obi Toppin.
It's not. I still keeping the eye on Thomas Bryant. I've just seen a lot of Thomas Bryant.
Thomas Bryant had a possession in Cleveland where he forced Evan Mobley to go to his offhand, then ran the full length of the floor for a high seal. There was some movement happening. He slid with Donovan Mitchell on a switch.
You hear that, Nakaz? You hear that, Nakaz? Yes, it's not me saying it.
Yes, as I said Monday, he has held up better defensively than I anticipated. I would like to see that sustained, but it has been better than I thought.
Some of the stuff at the level has been a little bit like, when I brought up the possession where Siakam was like, hey, Jarris, get over there. The reason he needed him to get over there was because the person turned around the edge at Thomas Bryant at the level. So...
There's room. Yeah, take that, Steve. No, I'm just kidding. But
well, actually, yeah, I have a level question. Miles Turner at the level.
Yeah.
I feel like it's been fun this year, especially with what he did to Cade in the Detroit game.
Yeah.
But also the times where it looks like he's going to be at the level, he's actually like, psych, I'm just going to stay with my man rolling. How have you liked the dynamic nature of Miles Turner's pick and roll defense?
he talked about this a little bit, that it was an adjustment for him. That last year, having them play him as high as they did, and you could see it, like, you know, they slip a lot of screens themselves, and they see that as a very dangerous play. So hence, defensively, they would typically have him up at the level, actually, like, giving his screener a little bit of a shove to make sure that they set the screen so that they couldn't slip out. There was times where that went well, and there was times where I felt like the ground coverage that he struggled with it. And I think that that led to some of the slippage. And I understand that, like, you know, under Nate McMillan, somewhat even under Nate Bjorkgren, what you as an NBA team were capable of doing has changed even just in that little amount of time. Like, his radius was much closer to the basket under Nate McMillan than it is now and what's possible now. So I understand from the coaching staff's perspective why they did it, but it was an adjustment. I think over, like, this last month, what you just said, I think is a really good point, because, like, even in the playoffs, there was times where, like, he's supposed to be hedging and preventing from Chris Middleton from getting out. It was like Chris Middleton was treating him like kind of like a saloon door. Like, he's still getting around the edge. And, like, last night he did that to Cade three separate times where it's like, okay, he actually walled up, made some contact, and it wasn't just diverting him. It was like Cade, you know, stopped his dribble and got off the ball. Like, that was definitely better. And I do think, like, the numbers with Miles here lately and in terms of what the actual rim frequency has been better. So I'm not going to say that it's perfect all the time, but I think that there's been some improvements just with his overall understanding of what his role is and what they need him to do and what his general commitment to it has been. And Rick kind of talked about it too last night. Like, he made a couple mistakes in the fourth quarter, but his overall mentality to be like, okay, I've let it go. Like, yes, Jalen Duren just dribbled past me and I fouled him and he got an and one out of it. But on the next possession, my compete level is back where it needs to be. Like, that wasn't always there earlier in the year, where sometimes those mistakes were sticking with him for a few possessions in a row.
I got you. I have a lineup / rotation question for you and just a general roster question. Sticking with the roster, as the Pacers, again, a top 6 seed right now, steadily climbing if they continue to play like this, for sure. Just looking ahead to the postseason, would you like to see Indy make any sort of, like, consolidation move or lower, like, buyout type move? Or are you fine with them kind of growing internally with the group that they have and maintaining that continuity?
Like, low level move, I don't think it would be the worst thing if they looked at adding a specialist for, like, a very end of the roster spot, just for the reasons that we were talking about earlier. Like, I don't necessarily think, you know, Doug McDermott wasn't the best fit. And it wasn't always, you know, making sense to me why Doug was playing in front of Jarris at times last year in the back end of the season. But when you do have somebody that it's like, hey, we trust you to go in against a couple possessions of zone, maybe you hit a three and maybe they come out of it, I think that might be something you might want to look at, just because, like I said, they don't have a lot of quick trigger movement shooters on the roster. And some of that ends up having to fall to Tyrese because he is the best one that they have. And then you're taking him off ball in order to do some of that. I still have some questions and some qualms about what their overall wing defense is, and exactly, I'm going to really want to watch over the back end of the season between Benedict and Mathern and Aaron Nesmith. Ben's made some strides defensively. My guess is, I guess we didn't really talk about this because both of them haven't been playing at the same time at the level that Ben's been playing at since he's a starter. You know, how do they envision that moving forward? What actually is the best thing for them at the small forward spot? Starting, is it Ben? Is it a case where eventually it ends up being Aaron again? I think for the time being, they're going to figure out if it is Ben. That's probably what I would do. Like, I would probably leave things as they've been, see how he continues to mesh with Tyrese, and if you need to make a change, then make a change. And then maybe it's possible that you realize you need to make even further change. I don't know that. That's my point. Like, I need to find out and figure that out. So I think that you're kind of at a point where you probably are all right if you do stand pat and you see how all of this plays out. But also, I'm not a huge cap person, not a huge salary person, but that is something they're going to have to figure out, because they do need to pay Miles Turner this summer. Ben is going to be extension eligible. You know, what are your priorities there, given that you've already, you know, handed out some extensions that some people interpreted as over the summer, like, hey, maybe these are deals for consolidation trades because they are going to need matching salary at some point in time. So that's kind of what I'm thinking going into it.
Yeah, makes sense. And then the lineup question I had, you already mentioned kind of the wing battle that's going to take place, assuming everyone stays healthy. I guess as of today, what do you think like the 8 or 9 man playoff rotation would be for Indy?
It's tough to say. The Ben Aaron thing, the thing between the two of them is Aaron's 3-point percentage really dropped in the playoffs last year, right? And he really can struggle to recapture his rhythm with a one dribble three. Some of the pull up two stuff was like, wow, this is really showing up in Game 7 when they need it the most, but it's not like a facet of his game. And the other aspect of it is like when they played New York and got absolutely smashed at Madison Square Garden, Aaron was starting and guarding Jalen Brunson. And now like part of the reason why that matchup has changed is there's so much more, you know, shooting on the floor for the Knicks is that what the Pacers did in the playoffs when Aaron was guarding Jalen Brunson, you know, having Pascal help off so much, having sometimes Andrew Nembhard help off so much, a lot of those helps, you know, couldn't be in as early and couldn't be as many jump switches because there's more switching on the floor. And then you're seeing like, okay, it wasn't just Aaron being a Jalen Brunson stopper. Like he's not stopping Jalen Brunson now that those things aren't behind him anymore. And then at the other end of the floor, Tom Thibodeau's like, I don't want Jalen Brunson guarding Tyrese. I don't want him guarding Andrew Nembhard because I don't want him navigating picks. Obviously, I'm not putting him on Pascal Siakam. I'm not putting him on Miles Turner. That means he's on Aaron Nesmith. And Aaron's not going to do very much to poke at that mismatch. Like if you can't stop Jalen Brunson, then maybe you need to stop him by forcing him to do something defensively. Ben is a lot more equipped at doing that than Aaron is. So that's kind of where I go back and forth with it. So if Ben can make contributions defensively, Ben seems like the clear answer to me there. If he can mesh with Tyrese and if their styles can continue to meld. Because like, I mean, there are times where Ben can be catch and hold, where Ben does look different than the rest of the offense. Aaron doesn't. Like Aaron fits this play style. He melds into it pretty well. And when he's hitting catch and shoot threes, he's going to consistently run the floor. He's going to consistently fit to the identity. So that's kind of the push and pull between the two of them. Like I said, I would probably look at it as it would be Ben's spot to lose because I think that that's valuable information that the Pacers need to have heading into next summer. If he were, then you have Aaron there and that's great. So I think that it probably comes down to answer your question, if you're going 8 or 9, you're probably looking at a choice between Ben Shepherd and Jairus Walker. And then also, like, is this a game where we want to play big and we want to play Thomas Bryant? Or is this a playoff series like against Milwaukee, sometimes against Boston, where we're just more comfortable playing small and we trim it by we're only going to play Miles Turner as the only big and we're going to play Obi and Pascal more at the front court bench spots is where I would imagine that the cutting and the trimming happens.
Got you. Steve, any closing Pacers thoughts or questions for Caitlin?
Come back to me in 30 seconds.
Okay, fair enough. In the meantime, Caitlin, any Pacers thing to...
Andrew Nembhard, all defense type player?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we didn't even talk about it. His newfound micro skill of pulling the chair on drives.
Against the drives, yeah.
That's a legitimate thing because like a lot of times we think of Andrew as like a weighted blanket because he does play so physical and strong defensively. But when I saw him do that against Jaylen Brown on that transition, I was like, that was deliberate. Like that wasn't just like, you know, I got knocked off my route. Like he was processing when Jaylen, like, especially because we talk about all the time, like how our defense is going to compensate for these players who are using their off arm a lot. Like I love Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but he does get a lot of play with that off arm. And like his next step is so unpredictable. So the fact that Andrew pulled that off against him, I've seen him do it against Devin Booker. He tried it against Darius Garland. I think he pulled it off against Chicago as well. Like that's just like to me, like pulling the chair in the post is one thing. Like, you know, when the next hit is coming, it's a static action. When you're doing that north south against a live dribble, like, and what the drive numbers are with him on versus off, like the Pacers on the season have been the worst team in the league defending drives. When he's on, you know, they're top 10 level when he's on the court. And that's, again, that's not just because of what he does on ball. It's also about what he does is like flex seal tape, really playing in the gaps. You know, he's somebody who he's capable of tagging and still intercepting a pass when he gets out. He's very good at finding the feel as a next defender, as a peel switch defender. There's a lot of special moments for him that you can see over the last month.
That micro skill you showed, I was terrified when I first saw the first couple clips. Because like, there's no way. Like, how are you going to be screen navigator and slide and then get out the way at the same time? But then the timing on that is pretty insane. And it's really genius. It's like, hey, you think you're taller than me, you're going to try and hit me. I'm not there anymore. Now what?
I want to know what they're going to call this move when other people start trying to do it. Because, like, Drew has the Drew. I think this should be the Nemhard.
I'm down. We could dub that right here. I say we call it the Nemhard. I think he has played at a super high level. I guess I just wonder, like, where he's going to land in terms of, like, games played and stuff.
Yeah.
As we get into the all-defense conversations. But he's certainly played at the level, especially since he's been back and off the minutes restriction, as you've said. I guess, Kaitlin, I'll open the floor to you. Is there any Pacer thing that we did not get into? Just you want to kind of empty the notebook on?
Man, I think we covered a lot of ground here today. I think that we touched on all of it.
There we go. And that is what I call a successful podcast. Well, then, last question I have for you. Where can the people find you? What do you have coming out? What should the people be looking forward to?
So my handle on X is at C2_Cooper. I'm also on Blue Sky now. That's my full name. So Kaitlin May Cooper at whatever. What is it, like .bluesky.social? I think that's what it is, what the handles are over there. I'm not sure.
Something like that.
So if you go there, the link to my Patreon's there, patreon.com/basketballshewrote. The coverage there goes from game to game. It's what I'm noticing in games. Most recently, I talked about what some of the adjustments were that Cleveland and the Pacers made in the two-game miniseries. Before that, I wrote in pretty in-depth terms like what I've seen differently from the defense. And then also what I'm really excited about is Samson Folk. I think he's one of the best writers out there. He's contributing for me on a once-a-month basis. He wrote a terrific piece on Andrew Nemhard and what difference he made coming back. And then the two of us do podcasting together. We're only going to be doing it, I think, like once a month when his schedule meshes up with mine. But we did it throughout the playoffs. Hopefully, if the Pacers are in the playoffs again, you'll be seeing a lot more of us than what you're seeing on a monthly schedule right now. But we really show film during it and break down what happened during the game and little nuances that we're both seeing. And I'm really happy that I get to highlight in his work and continue working with him. So it's not just me that you're getting. If you think, you know, man, this was unlistenable, I don't want to hear that anymore. maybe you'll enjoy his work in addition to mine. So I think that you get a pretty good deal when you come over there. And also, like, there's a free tier too. And I do some free trials once a month as well. So even if you just want to sign up and get a taste of what I do, that's a good way of doing it. And all you have to do is input your email address. So.
There we go. Well, first and foremost, I think everyone's going to enjoy this one. If you're listening to the Dunker Spot, I think you are used to X's and O's content, and you are just elite at what you do and have been for a very long time. So again, it's always a pleasure. Even outside the podcast, just tossing you random Pacers questions stuff. It's always a pleasure talking basketball with you. And this shone through on this podcast as well. Also, please subscribe or, you know, sign up for the Patreon with Kaitlin. It is really good stuff. This is not a make the guests look good thing. I am also a subscriber to the Patreon. I read it. I got a good kick out of you and Samson writing about Andrew Nemhard like a week apart. It's like he's really making an impact here. It's really good stuff. The podcast is enjoyable. Samson also doing really good work. I think Raptors Republic. I want to make sure I have the name right there. But and the way that you two describe things, I think, is probably my favorite part, because you get these super X's and O's thing, but then you just get, I don't know how, like, complimentary. I don't know how y'all put some of this stuff together when you're describing what these guys are doing on the floor. So if you want to learn more about words and how they can be put together, like, this is a great Patreon for you. So, Kayla, we appreciate you rocking with us. And thank you. Oh, Steve, any closing thoughts in general?
No, you already about to have okay. The outro. What do you mean, any closing thoughts?
Listen, I want to make sure I ain't, you know, stepping on your toes, et cetera. That's
but you
all.
Was about to leave, but you about to end the game anyways. What do you mean?
See, I messed up. That's why I wanted to circle back.
That, hey, did you have anything you want to say, bud?
Anyway, thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get podcasts, you can find us. Every Tuesday, that is the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday, we are on the Young Man of the Three YouTube channel, formerly the JJ Reddit YouTube channel. So if you want to get our analysis with plays spliced in with stat graphics, you get the Steve live reactions to some of my ridiculous takes. If you want the visual element, that is where you want to go on Tuesdays.
Speed
you
can follow up. Me.
I'm on Blue Sky in the Kaius NBA. Steve's on Blue Sky, Steve Jones 20. We talking more basketball next week. Enjoy your weekend. Happy unrivaled weekend to those who celebrate.
Follow Kaitlin Cooper, please.